best of days, it was the worst of days. That is the beginning line, I would guess most of you realize, from Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. And it was written about France in the 1760s and 70s. But it could easily have been written of our country. America that was started a full century before that with the prospect of freedom. Freedom to worship as you wanted. Freedom to work with the hope of being able to profit yourself. And for a large part, the first century of our existence, the crown really didn't care about what was happening in the New World. But that all changed in the 1750s. A war broke out in 1754 between the French and Indians and the American colonies. And Great Britain invested time, energy, and resources. And when the war was finally ended, King George decided it was time to exact profit from the colonies. He began to set upon a new set of tariffs, a new set of taxes. And in fact, from 1764 all the way until 1776, every person living in the New World felt the bondage of the crown. In 1775, patriots dressed as Indians went to the harbor in Boston and poured the tea of the British that was subject to this new tariff into the harbor. The response, although not technically war for another 2 years, was for all intents and purposes the beginning of the revolution. But the Continental Congress gathered on two separate occasions, the first time seeking, do we meet revolt? And the conclusion was no. We desire peace. But a young man, fiery orator, took to the pulpit of St. John's Church in Richmond, Virginia, and his speech included these words, "Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a God, a just God, who presides over the destinies of nations and will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Why stand we here idle? What is it, gentlemen, we wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what force others may take. But as for me, give me liberty or give me death." That last phrase from Patrick Henry's speech would become the rallying cry of the American Revolution. But as I was reading it this week, another part of the speech jumped out at me. I would suggest that behind almost everything that transpires leading up to America's independence, it is this belief that God is just, that God is fair. And that if God is a fair and just God, surely he would not try to oppress others. But I wonder, do you believe God is fair? Oh, I know that very few of us would be willing to ask that question out loud. But what about the person who goes to the doctor in prime of life and receives the prognosis, sorry, cancer, you have months to live? That young person who's snatched from our presence. Of that friend you were sure you could trust until they maliciously, intentionally harm you. What about that servant of the gospel who enters his church this morning only to be pulled out, tortured, and yes, perhaps even beheaded? If God is just, where is he? A just God would surely not ask any of us to suffer. I would like to suggest that it's not just us who struggle with that. But so did the recipients of Peter's letter. We're going through 2 Peter in our church. And I must admit, as I was preparing for this morning, I was hoping for visitors. People who aren't normally here. And I see several of them. But as I wondered what I should speak on, of all of the passages I could have chosen, I think this would have been my least favorite. And yet, at our church, we tend to go through books of the Bible, and the joy of that, and the struggle of that, is you're forced to deal with some really uncomfortable passages. like judgment. Let me just read the first 9 verses of 2 Peter chapter 2, where Peter writes these words. But there were also false prophets among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you. They will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the sovereign Lord who bought them, bringing swift destruction on themselves. Many will follow their shameful ways and will bring the way of truth into disrepute. In their greed, these teachers will exploit you with stories they made up. Their condemnation has long been hanging over them, and their destruction has not been sleeping. For God did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them into the gloomy dungeons to be held for judgment. If he did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood on the ungodly people, but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and 7 others, if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by burning them to ashes, and made them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued Lot, a righteous man, who was distressed by the filthy lives of the lawless men, for that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw on earth. If this is so, then the Lord knows how to rescue godly men from trials and to hold the unrighteous for the day of judgment, while continuing their punishment. For the few moments we have, and I don't want to take all morning, but I did want to consider false teachers. If you were here a couple weeks ago, we were in the first 3 verses, and the Apostle Peter says that you should expect false teachers. Chapter 1 ends with the defense of true prophets who share the more perfect word of God. But he says, as you read through all of human history, there have been false prophets. You should expect false teachers. And these false teachers will introduce these deceptive heresies that make us want to believe things that aren't true. But ultimately, these false prophets, in their greed, I like the way the King James translates it, because they literally translate it, in the greed, their teachers monetize their stories. Many follow them. Where's the judgment? Peter wants us to remember that there is judgment coming. But wait a second, I don't see any judgment. I mean, would ISIS exist if God was really going to judge false teachers? Would evil men profit like they do? Peter says all you have to do is review history. And he's going to pick out 3 things. And the 3 things that he chooses are admittedly difficult to understand. And I could very easily spend the rest of the morning on each one of these, but I want to get the big point. He begins by saying that these fallen angels, what do you know about angels? Angels are maybe one of the more discussed subjects and least understood. As you read through the Bible, they're in the book of Genesis all the way to the book of Revelation, but the truth is, we don't know very much about them, and a few times they're described to us, the writer has a terrible time. Multiple faces, wings, eyes over their whole body. What exactly are these angels? And my answer is, I don't really know, but I do know a couple things. One is that they are incredibly powerful. If you just drop down a couple verses, he's going to, beginning in the middle part of verse 10, say, bold and arrogant on these men, the false teachers, who are not afraid to slander celestial beings. Yet even angels, although they are much stronger and more powerful, as you read through the Old Testament particularly, you see angels show up a couple times. In the book of Exodus, God is bringing his people, Israel, out of Egypt. And as he does, in one night, one angel visits every home in all of Egypt and takes the life of the oldest son. Egypt was the lone superpower. It was the strongest army on the planet. And yet, one angel took the firstborn of all of them. You can go to 2 Kings. King Sennacherib, one of the most vicious, violent, horrific armies that have ever marched the face of this earth. Go back and read sometime about Assyria and just the horrors that they propagated. They surround Jerusalem, and Hezekiah, king of Israel, the king of Judah, prays to God, and in one night, one angel slays 185 of the best trained, the fiercest soldier the planet had. They're gone. Angels are powerful. They're also given an incredible privilege. They have this incredible opportunity to enter the very presence of God. The book of Job is a difficult book sometimes to follow, as there's all these discussions between the friends and Job, but at its core, it's a story in which we have the incredible privilege of seeing what's transpiring in heaven, as well as what's happening on earth. And what we are introduced to is God regularly gathers his court, filled with angels. Would you love to be in the presence of God and see his majesty? Angels do that regularly. And yet, even though these angels are more powerful, more majestic, they sin. The question quickly arises, what exactly was their sin? And the answer is, we're not 100% sure. There's kind of two opinions. The one is that they followed Satan. If you go back and you read Isaiah chapter 28 and Ezekiel, or Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, you will find a story of how Satan rebels. And some will say that that's what's transpiring here. And he says that they're sent to hell. Now we're wading into topics most of us are very uncomfortable with, myself included. The word he uses here is a word that would have been very familiar to the first century Greek. It's a word from Greek mythology. I don't know if you enjoy Greek mythology. I wish my second daughter was here this morning because she's intrigued by it. And I could ask Abby to explain exactly what Tartarus was. That's the word that's used here. It was part of Greek mythology that there was Hades, the place of the dead. But for the incredibly wicked, the titans, the evil gods, the horrible people, they went to the lowest of lows, a place of utter torment. That's the word that Peter uses here. You say, so is Peter endorsing Greek mythology? No. In fact, one of the struggles any communicator has is when trying to talk about a subject the listeners have never heard, the only options you have are things that you're familiar with. And in fact, as you go through the entire Bible, when we talk about hell, hell is more horrific than any one of us can understand, let alone describe. Jesus, his favorite illustration of hell was Gehenna. Now, that doesn't mean anything to us, but if you were a first century Jew, you realize that Gehenna was the mountain just outside the wall of the city. It was the refuse dump. It was the place garbage was sent, waste was collected, and there was always a fire burning. And Jesus describes this place of intense torment as this unending fire of this horrific stench. The Old Testament authors usually called it Sheol. Sheol was a place of utter futility, a place of intense frustration, a place free from the presence of God. Peter, I think, is using an illustration that his readers would have understood to speak of this horrific place where they were kept for punishment. In fact, they're there today, I would argue, and they are still there. These fallen angels who sinned, perhaps with Satan, perhaps they sinned, and Jude seems to indicate that their sin was some abstract sexual sin. And if you have time this afternoon, back in Genesis chapter 6, I would love to talk to you, but I don't want to take that, because I believe Peter's point is not to get into the finer details of exactly what the sin was, but the recognition that fallen angels sinned and got judgment. He shares the second illustration, and that is the flood. This probably isn't the best morning to share this illustration, but if we were at church, you would realize that we've remodeled our nursery. And if you go into the nursery, you'll find some things missing. There's a wall missing. There's several things missing. But one of the things that's especially missing is this lovely picture that used to be a border all the way around the top. Noah's Ark, for whatever reason, is this incredible, fun cartoon picture of lions and tigers and bears. Oh my, it's just all of these lovable creatures all together hanging out with beavers eating holes in the boat. We think of it as a fun picture. May I suggest that the image we ought to have is something like this? God sent judgment. He took the life every human being other than me. A couple weeks ago, I showed my citizen class a video of a former pastor of one of the fastest growing churches in America who wrote a book several years ago entitled Love Wins. He suggested that hell cannot be real because a true God would never judge the majority. What do you do with the flood? We don't know how many people were alive during the flood, but probably thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions. And 8 people survived. What was so terrible? I mean, what exactly was this horrific sin that they did? Well, if you read in Genesis chapter 9, it says that the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth. Every intention of his thoughts was only evil continually. And you can conjure up some incredible things. But can I paint a picture that I'll never forget? Several years ago, we went through the Gospel of Luke. And towards the end of the Gospel of Luke, Jesus turns to the subject of his return. And in Luke 17, he says, just as in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days of the Son of Man. There will be these horrific sins of eating, drinking, and marrying. How horrible is that? Can you imagine people eating and drinking? What? In a few minutes, if I ever stop talking, you're going to eat and drink. Is that some horrific sin? I would argue Jesus' point is this. They went about life as if God didn't exist. God never entered their thoughts at all. Let me ask you about last week. How many times did you think about God? How many times did you intentionally invite Him into your life, into your thoughts, into your actions? The sin of the flooded world was not this horrific act of sin, but rather it was just a complete denial God exists. How they were living. God says, you break my heart. And he said, no. But Noah was there. In fact, one of the great truths is that Noah was willing to be a preacher of godliness. And my computer just crashed, so you just have to pretend up there. It says that Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was this incredible illustration in the midst of this horrific sin in which he focused on God alone. He then goes to a third illustration. The third illustration is that of Sodom and Gomorrah. My guess is that most of us think of Sodom and Gomorrah in not particularly flattering ways. In fact, it's become almost a punchline when we want to speak of something evil, we speak of Sodom and Gomorrah. But the question that arises in my mind when you begin to think about God sending judgment, fire from heaven, it's interesting. If I had time, I'd go on a rabbit trail right now that Peter in chapter 2 uses two illustrations of destruction, flood, and fire. We're going to come back to that in chapter 3, and he's going to use two illustrations of destruction. God flooded the entire world once. He will destroy the entire world by fire a second time. But back to Sodom, we oftentimes think about Sodom because Sodom was guilty of the worst sin possible, right? That's why God judged them. Clearly what was happening in Sodom is the worst thing people can do. What exactly was the sin of Sodom? Before you answer that, I'd encourage you to go back to Ezekiel chapter 16. Because in Ezekiel chapter 16, the prophet Ezekiel is going to talk about Sodom, and what he is going to condemn them of is this. They were prosperous. They sought pleasure. They saw the needy and said, I'm not interested. And thus committed horrible abominations. Ezekiel says the sin of Sodom was that they were consumed by pleasure and didn't care about the people around them. Doesn't sound like any place you've ever visited, does it? Well, you say, oh, okay, maybe they weren't guilty of the worst sin, but they must have been the worst city. As you come forward to the stories of Jesus, Jesus' hometown, adopted hometown, becomes the city of Capernaum. And while in the city of Capernaum, Jesus makes an amazing statement. He says to Capernaum, if the miracles that were done here had been done in Sodom, Sodom would still exist. And on the day of judgment, it will be more pleasant for Sodom than Capernaum. Capernaum was a worse city than Sodom, so why in the world, if they're not guilty of the worst sin, if they're not guilty of being the worst sinners ever, why does God judge them? Well, Peter tells us why. They were judged to be an example to you that God takes sin seriously. He will judge. There is judgment coming. But once again, he says, of rescue, righteous Lot. Oh, wait a second here. I'm sorry, but the words righteous and Lot shouldn't go together. I mean, if you remember this story, the angels come to Lot's house. The entire city comes out and says, hey, give us those two men that entered your house. We want to rape them. And he says, you can't rape them. Here are my daughters. Rape them. What kind of father throws his daughters out to an angry mob to be raped? The angel said, we're leaving because God's going to destroy the city. And Lot says, okay. And then eventually they have to grab him and drag him off. His wife is so enamored by the city that even though she recognizes that there will be great consequences if she turns around anyway. The cities, they is destroyed. And as it's being destroyed, God says, go here. And Lot says, no, God. Can I go over there? He goes over there and his daughters get him drunk and both his daughters sleep with him. And he has children by his own daughters. I'm sorry. That doesn't sound like a righteous man to me. How in the world can Peter call Lot righteous? I would suggest the reason is because Lot was not righteous by what he did, but in whom he believed. We could go back and I could develop Romans, the first four chapters, and in the first three chapters, Paul is going to make certain we all understand all of us have sinned. All of us have fallen short of the glory of God. Every single one of us have failures in our life. Abraham, the father of faith, why was he righteous? Was it righteous because of what he did? Paul says no. Was it righteous because he practiced the right religious practices? I mean, after all, he was circumcised. Paul says no. Paul says the reason Abraham was righteous because he believed God. And God took the righteousness of Christ and credited it to his account. Lot was righteous for one reason. Because he trusted God. And God heaped upon him the righteousness of his son. In fact, I think it's really fascinating. Ezekiel chapter 14, Ezekiel speaking about the judgment of God. And he says, even if the greatest man who ever lived came, who are the greatest men? Well, let's see. There's Job. Read the book of Job sometimes. See what he endured. There's Daniel. Daniel was an amazing man. But leading the list in the number one position is Noah. And then he includes Lot. May I suggest every single person in this room is someplace between Noah and Lot. And yet both were deemed righteous. Not because of what they had done, but because of whom they believed. And thus, Peter is going to share that God did not spare the angels. God did not spare the world of the ancient world of the flood. God did not spare even Sodom and Gomorrah. And in verse number 9, he makes a rather interesting statement. It's one of the longest sentences, an entire sentence in the English Bible. Peter says, if God didn't spare the angels, if God didn't spare the world of the flood, if God didn't spare Sodom and Gomorrah, then what do you expect him to say? I expect him to say that he's not going to spare the wicked of today. That's not what he says. He says, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly in trials. Peter wants us to remember, judgment is coming. I don't know when. Maybe today. Maybe in none of our lifetime. But every single one in this room, whether you're in your 80s or you're a few months old, one day God, and you will stand in the presence of holy, powerful God, and it will be time to answer. Why should you get into heaven? I can promise you none of us will be be able to get there on our own. None of us are perfect. See, I hear far too often we misunderstand what sin is. Sin is not simply the bad things I do. Sin is any time that I fail to follow the will of God for the glory of God through the power of God. Sin is not just the bad things I do, but the good things I fail to do. It's not just hitting my neighbor because he angers me, but failing to treat my neighbor kindly. The reality is all of us fall short, and yet God's willing to rescue his righteous servants if we believe. So what can I take from a passage like this? What can you take? Let me just see if I can't throw out four suggestions. The first is, judgment is coming. It might be delayed. If you read Genesis chapter 6, it indicates that Noah built a boat for 120 years. The people of Noah's day had a 120-year warning. And yet judgment eventually comes. We're going to get to chapter 3 eventually. In chapter 3, Peter's going to make this point. God is very patient. He's long-suffering, not willing for anyone to perish. But the day of the Lord will come. God's patient. Second thing, it's interesting that Noah is called a preacher of righteousness. Because he knew judgment was coming, he told others. But before you conclude, preachers are people like me who stand up in front of others and talk nonstop for hours. Do you know that's the only place in the entire Bible Noah's ever called a preacher? Do you know what he's normally called? Obedient. Faithful. In fact, I would argue that Noah's preaching was done as he was building. It was done at his workplace. In fact, as he continued to obey God in the midst of this incredible sin around him, his faithfulness opened the conversations, and as people saw his life, they simply asked, why? May I suggest, though you may never stand where I'm standing this morning, anyone who has been forgiven has an incredible privilege and hefty responsibility to share the righteousness of God with others. You all are preachers. The question is not, are you a preacher? It's how effective are you? The third thing, as you look at Lot, I think I can make an argument that living a righteous life in a wicked world is extremely hard, but not impossible. Lot isn't going to be on the cover of any Christian of all time. He's not in Hebrews 11, the great Hall of Fame, and yet he struggled, as I guess some of you, and as I often do. And yet he was still described as righteous. But without question, the point that I want no one to miss is that judgment is coming. Are you ready? Bow your hearts. God, I thank you for the chance to gather. I thank you for all the fun that we're going to have, for the food downstairs, for the pool, for the miniature golf, the zip line, all of the fun that we will have this afternoon. God, I pray that you would keep us safe, that you would give us an incredible morning together. But I pray most of all that every single one of us would make certain that we know that we are forgiven. Not because we are better than others, but because you are a gracious God. God, I pray that you would help us make certain that we have received the gift that you offer. Thank you. Here it is in Jesus' name.